I'd like to share a little song with you about blessing and healing in a language. A fellow by the name of Jeff gave me this song. He's allowed me to share it. So, you ready?
Ready.
Dan gan bi an ni an kiaraba Nooder by dang by in yaraba Nooder ni an ni an yaraba Ni an yaraba Ni an yaraba.
The song you just heard was sung by an Aboriginal person living in, or perhaps we should say, on Australia. As he said, it is a song of blessing and healing. And as you'll hear in this episode, those sentiments are largely what's needed in Australia, and they're what many Aboriginal people are actively seeking in various ways. Welcome to Lost Cultures, Living Legacies, a podcast from Travel and Leisure. I'm your host, Alicia Prakash. What can we learn about a place by delving into the people who once lived there? In what ways do cultures build upon each other as populations come and go? How do they complement each other, interact, and leave their marks on the people that come after them? And are cultures truly ever lost, even if the people move on? If ever a culture or group of cultures deserved healing, it's the Aboriginal people of Australia. They belong to bloodlines and cultures whose traditions span further back in time than most people can even begin to comprehend. But like so many Indigenous or First Nations people around the world, the clarity of their ancestral lines and cultural practices were disrupted and obscured by the arrival of European colonizers. That said, much is being done to reconnect people to their birthrights as descendants of the original inhabitants of the continent. And just a note before we introduce our guests for this episode. In addition to the Aboriginal people we'll be focusing on, another group Indigenous to the Australian continent is known as the Torres Strait Islander peoples. Unfortunately, both groups face similar challenges as Europeans arrived. So keep that in mind, and we encourage you to seek out more information on them. At the start of our episode, we heard from the founder and director of Giri Gira, a company that offers eco-friendly tours and experiences on New South Wales' central coast that allow visitors to interact with Aboriginal culture. He joined us remotely from an eco-garden, so you may hear birds or other noises in the background. Here he is again to further introduce himself.
My name's Tim Selwyn. My father was of third generation of English descent, so I acknowledge my English bloodline. My Indigenous connection to Earth Mother here in Australia from my mum's line goes all the way back to the Wongaiban people in the central west of New South Wales, and that's my family line. But my mum was born in what we call Wiradjuri country, and we follow our mother's bloodline, so to speak, so I'm Wiradjuri by birth.
In terms of my own personal connection, it's through my father, who was an Aboriginal man, and then through my grandmother. After that, a number of generations.
This is Rob Hyatt, the Cultural Education and Visitor Experience Manager at the Quarry Heritage Trust in Melbourne.
I feel I'm lucky enough to be able to trace back a few generations. My grandmother was actually part of the Stolen Generations, and my great-great-grandmother was also removed from her family. Sometimes we are lucky to trace that back. And so I have a connection to a couple of nations in particular here in Victoria, so the Wotjobaluk people and then the Yanai Kurnai people.
Yamakura, that means hello with respect in my language. My name is Laura McBride, and I'm Director First Nations at the Australian Museum. I'm a Walwan and Kuma woman. My father was born on a place called Monkeela Bend, which is a river bend on the Namoi River in a town in western New South Wales called Walgett. In 1957, the year he was born, Aboriginal people were living primarily in fringe camps, missions or reserves. In 1957, my father wasn't classified as an equal Australian citizen, and today does not identify as Australian, and neither do I. I identify as Walwan, Kuma, and my mother is English. My mother travelled from England, migrated here when she was 16 years old. Her stepfather was recruited from England to a church in Coonamble, New South Wales, where my family was living at the time. And my mother, when she entered the high school, wasn't necessarily accepted by all the kids there. She had a thick English accent, different fashion, wore thick glasses. And so she describes it as she was sort of sent off with the uncool kids and went home with them and realized that there were Aboriginal people in this country. She had no realization of that before coming here and made friendships with my dad's sisters and eventually met my father. I grew up between Sydney, New South Wales. I was born on Gadigal country. That is where I am now. That's the name of the country for Sydney City. And grew up 9 months of the year here doing my schooling with my mother and 3 months of the year with my father in Coonamble, New South Wales. So I grew up completely between what is my Aboriginal family and then in Sydney also.
Our three guests today each live on the island continent of Australia and are of Aboriginal descent. Just as with other cultures and peoples we've discussed so far on this podcast, though, the experience of Aboriginal people on Australia is not monolithic. So what does it mean to be Aboriginal today?
I think a lot of people internationally, what they don't understand about particularly Aboriginal people, because the way Indigenous people are classified in America under blood quantum, it's very different. So Aboriginality in this country is a way of being, thinking and knowing. It's not only race, it's religion as well. So it's how you grow up. I was born Aboriginal and read as an Aboriginal woman. I'm proud Aboriginal woman. So that's my primary identity. When it comes to traditions and customs, at the time my father was born, people weren't necessarily allowed to speak their languages or undertake any of their what would be seen as traditional customs or our cultures at the time.
Aboriginal Australia today, through the latest census report or government gathering of information, puts us at about 3% of the total population of Australia, which is a fairly small number. When the Europeans first came into these coasts, they brought in all those diseases and that pretty well smashed us, wiped us out. That would have been probably our first pandemic on this continent. They're saying 80% of the population pretty well died. Most Aboriginal people didn't even see a European, so to speak, and the disease went ahead. So there's not many of us.
There's a real diversity of the lived experiences for Aboriginal people. There's people that grew up speaking language. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to grow up with language, and a lot of my family still live on an old mission here in Victoria. And so for me, my engagement with culture and my practice of culture is actually about gathering. My sense of my own Aboriginality and identity comes through my connection with family and community. My expression of culture, as much as anything else, is more about storytelling, connecting and maintaining really strong family relationships. You're always a community member, and with all of those connections and relationships nice and tight, then you have the sense of your culture.
So as our guests have mentioned, the invasion of Australia by colonizers from Europe deeply impacted the Aboriginal peoples there.
The first thing a country does, tries to dominate you, takes away your language and takes away your spirituality and tries to assimilate you or basically kill you. Like a lot of countries, you'll go secretly. You'll stop a lot of the physical ceremonial aspects, but you'll continue to do the stuff, the deep stuff. So my family, I'm very privileged to have my family have continued those practices through all those years. And you go quite secretive, try and protect that stuff. And it's only been in the last 10 years people are now wanting to learn more about connection to Australia, and even most Aboriginal people are disconnected. So that 3% I mentioned, who knows how many of them haven't done a layer of ceremony or connection to Mother Earth, and how many of that little tiny group have, and at what level of connection or a level that can conduct ceremonies, rites of passages and connections. It's a very, very small group. And I'm very honoured to be part of that group. It comes with a lot of weight, a lot of responsibility, hence why the secrecy, the tendency to go slow to make that right decision. Just because I've done layers of ceremony doesn't make me a good person, nor does it make me a spiritual person. It means I've been given tools and opportunity to share that with the right people, which comes to another layer. How do you share and who do you share to? I went into tourism initially to try and help people see landscape through my lens, if you like, and quickly got into education. And I now have a company. There's several people that work with me. But again, it's a slow process, but it's more about leaving footsteps for people that follow, I suppose. It's not about the now. It's about 200, 300, 400, 500 years in the future, what it's going to look like. And most people only look at next year, or most companies only have a 10 or 20 year plan. But people on this continent, we've been thinking about our grandkids, 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 and how that's going to look by our actions today.
And there is extremely good reason for Tim Selwyn and others who are part of Aboriginal communities to be thinking centuries ahead. After all, 5 centuries is almost nothing compared to the depth of history that already exists for Aboriginal cultures.
So if we were to look at traditional Aboriginal Australia, it was made up of a number of nations, all with their own languages, their creation stories, their ways of life. But across Australia, there is over 270 nations. Across those nations, over 700 dialects. And so the diversity of actual Australia was extreme in terms of just pure numbers of peoples, nations, identities, and culture. And culture could be very different right across the state and right across the country in terms of landscape and how you lived within that landscape. So it was a real synergy between people and environment and how you lived within that environment. And to a certain extent, from an Aboriginal cultural point of view, the earth was mother and she provided, and you then lived on country and you nurtured country. But obviously Australia being such a large area, the environments change and shift dramatically from our coasts to our rainforest to central desert. The culture that was a part of those areas was very different. And so the people were very different. And you do see a lot of that still today in many aspects. But colonisation, unfortunately, impacted on that.
We have a matriarchal society. We follow the mum's bloodline, our mother. We look at the ocean as mother's womb, mother's waters. Here we call the ocean saltwater garawa. The surface of mother in itself, we have a single sky father. He sits up in Orion's belt today. So that's our sky father up there. He looks down top. It's our seed, our origin, if you like. Our origins come from the stars, come from aliens, if you like. Our Earth Mother bore us via ocean, so evolution is part of that story. We are on the oldest continent of the world, Australia. We have the oldest continuous cultures in the world today. There's many, many stories. I'll flip between opinion and fact, and anthropologists and archaeologists are putting us on this continent now for 110,000 years. I'll say it again, 110,000 years, because that's a number. Has a lot of debate. Not even most Aboriginal people in the education department, the government, want to recognise that. They're still pushing us back at about 60,000. There's a number of reasons why they do that, but the facts are archaeologists, anthropologists, scientists put us here at 110,000 years.
And the debate and scepticism that Tim Selwyn describes around just how long people have been on Australia is indeed very real. But research presented in 2019 by prominent academics does point to the possibility that people may have been on the continent as far back as around 120,000 years ago, which is at least twice as far back as most people previously tended to think.
I'm connected here to this Earth Mother, and on the surface of our Earth Mother, you have your obligations and responsibilities. So in other words, when you are born, where you were born, is where you have obligation and responsibility to look after that part of Earth Mother. So in Australia, we have many, many, many different tribes, but really we're all the same. We all have areas of responsibility from the alpine to the deserts to the tropics. It's just a different part of Mother that we have our responsibilities. And our father gave us rules at the beginning of time, whenever that was, and those rules, they're still there, but not all Aboriginal people know about them or aware of them. They want to, but we believe in reincarnation as well. So when you die, your spirit goes up into what we call the Milky Way, the Mirrabooka. And in the Mirrabooka, there's a place called heaven, if you like, Bulama, we call it here. And in Bulama, you wait to be reborn again. And the stars are either your ancestors or they're the campfires of your ancestors sitting up in Bulama waiting to be reborn. So when you come back, you primarily come back to Earth as a plant or animal. Rarely you come back as human, but usually if there's a pregnant woman in our community and we see a shooting star or a falling star, that's an indication that there's a human baby coming back. So that little bub could be born a senior or an elder from birth, a chief or a queen from beginning, so they'll be elevated straight away. They'll have a higher level in the community.
It should be noted that the various Aboriginal nations had their own diverse creation stories related to the ways they lived their lives and practiced their cultures. When Australian anthropologists of European descent attempted to study and document Aboriginal cultures in the late 1800s, they referred to the spiritual beliefs and creation stories of Aboriginal people collectively as the dreaming or dream time. When we reached out to Rob Hyatt to ask his thoughts, he had this to say about the use of the term dream time. Quote, "For me, the term dream time diminished the importance of these creation stories, almost implying them as simply a dream or fantasy, as opposed to the Christian story of creation being implied as fact against those stories of First Nations people. Dream time also implies that the stories had an endpoint rather than a continuous, living connection to lore and culture still practiced today." And he had this to say about the term dreaming. Quote, "The term dreaming can imply a continuous story and therefore a continuous connection to and practice of traditional lore and culture. However, for some, it still relates to the word dream and can diminish the importance of the stories for Aboriginal people today." Rob also stressed that those were his perspectives, but suffice it to say that the use of terms like dreaming and dream time have been called into question. And the ways in which anthropologists who coined and popularized both those terms and the interpretations of Aboriginal beliefs they represent are likely best thought of as misunderstandings, or at least oversimplifications, of the diverseness and complexity of the actual beliefs they were meant to explain. In addition to the beliefs of Aboriginal people about where they come from, there are also scientific theories that have them arriving on Australia from Southeast Asia. It's possible that they were able to cross the seas during an era when they were low, and there were shorter distances between land masses in that part of the world. And it's also theorized that whoever these people were, they may have been the earliest successful seafarers in history. In the end, though, just as Tim Selwyn and earlier Rob Hyatt laid out, they developed into a multitude of cultures who were very in touch with the various environments they inhabited across the continent. Unfortunately, though, as all our guests have already alluded to, and just as we've discussed in previous episodes, the arrival of Europeans had a cataclysmic impact on the delicate balance of people and place that existed before colonization. Laura McBride again.
So here we'll talk about invasion, but there wasn't one invasion. The first invasion happened right close by to where I'm sitting today. In 1788, the first fleet arrived in what's known as Port Jackson, now Circular Quay or Sydney Harbour. Some of those main landmarks that might be recognised there now are the Opera House or the Harbour Bridge. And in a lot of Australian history, our National Day of Celebration celebrates that moment. Australia Day is the day in which the First Fleet arrived in Sydney Harbour. That's obviously a day of mourning or a day of survival, or referred to as Invasion Day by Aboriginal people. But really, invasions happened across the country. So first of all, this particular area was invaded, and then there were a series of invasions over time, decades, throughout the rest of Australia. They first tried to make a settlement in what's known as Camay or Botany Bay and couldn't find a good source of running water, so moved up to this part of what's now known as Sydney City. The Sydney Basin actually took a great number of years to successfully colonise, essentially ending on what's now known as the Appin Massacre and a turning of the tide. So the Australian colony was led by military men, and it was a military takeover.
And so we were first colonised under the term of Terra Nullius, where Terra Nullius basically meant an empty continent or a land without people. Basically, Australia was seen as empty and there to take. And so that's why Australia today still is one of the only Commonwealth nations in the world that does not have a treaty with its First Nations people. We're still in the processes of negotiating treaty. In fact, Aboriginal man was considered subhuman at one point, but we had human remains removed for study overseas to see where Aboriginal man may fit in the chain of evolution. And so, you know, there was some really harsh, atrocious acts within our country. And part of that early colonisation did include hunting and poisoning and killing of Aboriginal people. But one of the things I personally like to talk about, and I know many Aboriginal people do across our country, is that there is a myth that there was no resistance, there was no resilience.
What's been written out of history, particularly here in Australia, is the massive resistance of Aboriginal people across time. And here at the Australian Museum, we have recently held an exhibition called Unsettled, which closed in January 2021, which was the first major truth-telling exhibition in any major cultural institution here in Australia. And in that exhibition, we did focus a large section on showing that everybody, whether it was newspaper articles or journals or letters, and even by the military commanders themselves, all believed that they were living in periods of warfare through their own languages. That over time has been written out of history, essentially to justify the colonisation of Australia. So a good example of that is Captain Cook is often looked at as a hero for many non-Indigenous Australians, though I feel that's changing now. But Lieutenant Cook, as he was known when he mapped the east coast of Australia, was killed by the Hawaiians 8 years before they actually set up a colony here in Sydney. It wasn't until around the early 1900s with the White Australia policy and the Federation of Australia itself and Australia trying to create itself as a nation that Captain Cook narrative came about. But many Australians would believe that, you know, Captain Cook founded Australia.
James Cook was an officer in the British Royal Navy who was charged with a scientific voyage related to tracking the transit of Venus across the sun in order to calculate the size of the solar system. As that part of the expedition ended, he opened a set of secret secondary orders to map the coastline of New Zealand and then, quote unquote, discover the continent rumored to exist nearby. Cook's expedition arrived at what is now Point Hicks in April of 1770. He and his crew became the first known Europeans to encounter Aboriginal Australians as they mapped the eastern coast of the landmass over several months. But as Laura McBride alluded to, Cook was killed by the people of Hawaii in 1779 after generally mistreating them and while personally attempting to kidnap their king. This was more than 8 years after Cook left Australia and still years before the first fleet from Britain arrived in 1788 to establish a penal colony. We'll be back with more after the break. I'm Alicia Prakash, and you're listening to Lost Cultures, Living Legacies, a podcast from Travel and Leisure.
So as we went through that period of colonization or settlement, or as we term, invasion, we saw a shift in terms of landscape as much as anything else. And so when the first settlers or invaders, if you like, came up into what we now know as the Melbourne area, that was back in 1835. And at that time, the area was bogs and lagoons and marshes, but it was a river mouth as part of a bay. So they did see it as an appropriate place to settle. And what they did was then, over time, modified the landscape. They changed the course of the river, even widened the river. They took out waterfalls. They started to plant European grasses to sustain their sheep and cattle. And so the landscape of Melbourne dramatically changed. But because of that change to the environment, and the synergy Aboriginal people had with their environment culturally, it also forced a shift for the people, unfortunately, as well. And so there was damage to the Aboriginal people, to the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the area. And we saw this right across the country, really. The Aboriginal people started to be removed off country and removed to different places, usually away from what we might term as our white towns and centres, but also just off country for settlement within our regional areas as well. And predominantly a lot of that movement was then onto missions and reserves. And once on the missions and reserves, in parts of our country, inclusive of Victoria, it was illegal at one point for an Aboriginal person to speak language and to practice culture. That's why, unfortunately, we lost some of that practice here in our state.
Let's go back for a moment, though, to something Laura McBride mentioned. The Appin Massacre occurred on April 17, 1816, when several Aboriginal people were killed by British forces. This happened as a result of orders by the governor of New South Wales, Lachlan Macquarie, that authorized a campaign of terror against quote-unquote hostile natives, which allowed them to be killed and strung up from trees as warnings or to be taken as hostages or prisoners of war. According to the Australian Museum's Unsettled exhibition, killing became a regular tactic of the colonizers once they arrived on the continent and met resistance from the Aboriginal people they encountered there. The idea that wars were fought between the colonizers and the original inhabitants of the land has been disputed for political reasons throughout the years. But the use of words like invasion and war to describe the arrival of the Europeans and the subsequent conflicts they brought with them is not only an attempt at a political reclamation, it is also, perhaps more simply, an attempt to offer a more honest narrative on behalf of the people who had the experience forced on them. And as both McBride and the Unsettled exhibition point out, the language of Governor Macquarie and others at the time proves that the aggressors themselves considered what they were doing to be warfare.
It's just not the dominant narrative. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples mitigate false and negative stereotypes on a nearby weekly, if not daily, basis. This comes from how Aboriginal people have been represented over time, and that's how we're perceived. So that representation is deeply embedded into the structures of Australian society, and Aboriginal people need to mitigate that constantly when engaging with, it could be your local school, museums, colonial museums, who hold a lot of people's cultural objects that were taken from them at times when they themselves were not legally allowed to practice their own cultures.
Let's return to exactly what McBride said earlier, though.
The Sydney Basin actually took a great number of years to successfully colonize, essentially ending on what's now known as the Appin Massacre and a turning of the tides.
That turning of the tides, which began with the massacre, continued with a proclamation by Governor Macquarie meant to restrict large gatherings and movements of Aboriginal people, and also to regulate what they were allowed to carry. And while this proclamation was made to the colony at New South Wales, it was indicative of the treatment that Aboriginal people would receive across the continent for decades to come. But as the years passed, the toolkit of oppression was expanded to include tactics such as forced assimilation or kidnapping and torture.
I mean, essentially it's classified as genocide. There are two main definitions of genocide, and we meet them both here in Australia.
According to the Unsettled exhibit, quote, "The term genocide has been seen as controversial when used to describe the treatment of First Nations peoples as part of the colonization of Australia. But what happened fits the definition," end quote. So with that in mind, the United Nations definition of genocide includes two main elements. First, there is the mental element, or quote, "intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group," end quote. Second, there is the physical element, and this includes killing members of the group, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. Again, according to Unsettled, quote, "Massacres, dispossession, dispersals, sterilization of Aboriginal women, forced child removals, and assimilation policies, all acts of genocide, have been committed against First Nation peoples," end quote.
So the forced sterilization of Aboriginal women occurred across the country. My own mother-in-law was forcefully sterilized in Grafton Base Hospital in 1984 after she gave birth to my partner. That same doctor also forcefully sterilized other Aboriginal women, so she wasn't the only woman. Many of the elders I meet when we're talking about these projects have also told me their own stories about forceful sterilization. So this is essentially one generation above me and not too long ago. That's one element of genocide. The other is the removal of children, what's now commonly known as the stolen generations.
The Stolen Generations is a term that is generally used to describe the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children who were removed from their families from the 1910s to 1970s. It is important to note, though, that according to Unsettled, Aboriginal children were removed from their families from the early decades of the colony. But it became official legislative policy in 1915 with the passage of the Aborigines Protection Amending Act. The idea of removing children from their families and communities to be raised among colonizers was rationalized as protection against neglect, though perhaps we should say perceived neglect if we're being generous, or imagined neglect if we're being realistic. But the rationalizations didn't end there. It was also claimed by the government that quote-unquote pure-blood Aboriginal people were bound to die out, which meant so-called mixed-blood children would be better off assimilating. Of course, this conveniently leaves out that the reason the so-called pure-blood population might have died out is because they were undergoing a concerted effort to make them die out by the very people so unconvincingly worried about their predicament. Tim Selwyn again.
People say that the Stolen Generation was done with good intention, and we are still recovering and we are still in pain and we are still hurting from that today. There are people in their 60s and 70s trying to find their ancestral line because it's been disconnected and taken away. That's extremely traumatic. In our bloodlines, in our skin groups, they call them fats and meats. We have obligation and responsibility. You know where you're from. You know what your responsibilities are, you know where you fit, and you know where you're going. With the British rule, they took all that away. They flipped our culture upside down, arrogantly.
My grandmother was actually removed from her family at Lake Tyres at around about the age of two and moved into Melbourne and raised in a convent and trained to become a domestic servant. Unfortunately, she never saw Lake Tyres again, the mission, and had very little contact with her family over time. And that meant that my father didn't have great contact with his family. But for me, I managed to take that journey, find my grandmother's people, and therefore find that family. Around the age of 18, which was lucky for me, because I'm in my 50s now, so I've had a history or a life journey with family and a life journey with my culture and my Aboriginality. But I know plenty of people, older adults, unfortunately, in our communities, 50s and 60s, that are still trying to make that connection. And so that past has had a major impact, unfortunately does continue to impact today, but what we are seeing is survival.
The personal journey for me is that my mum wasn't allowed to, because of the colour of her skin, go into higher education. My mum never read to me as a child. My dad ran away from home when he was 14. They were both semi-illiterate, if you like, so I never did homework. I like to tell this story to teenagers when they go to school. School is a privilege. To have a decent opinion, you need to have a knowledge and need to know all sides of that story before you step forward. So we teach young people, if you don't know, don't do. That's the problem with the world today. They push us too hard to make decisions, where some of the decisions that my old people made were 200-300 years in the future decisions. So my mum not reading to me and not having the capabilities to share that, when I went to school, I was struggling to read and write. What that does is creates a mentality about Aboriginal people are dumb, that puts Aboriginal people a second class. I cannot remember the first 8 years of my life. I don't know why it's blocked out there. I don't even know if I want to go back and revisit that, but obviously it must have been traumatic for me not to remember that. I would say that would be in relationship to learning and what I received when I went to school. So all the other kids read and write, and if I was struggling with that, probably got teased, who knows. So this is all product of colonisation. This is all product of dispossession.
Another result of the child removal policies and the history of colonial oppression and struggle before that is that adapting to Western cultural norms became a way of keeping a family intact.
The reason being for this is if your children were practicing cultures, they're at a high risk of being removed from their families. So conforming to the dominant Western control was how people survived. So my great-grandmother, my father's grandmother, is what's called my apical ancestor. So she's essentially my first contact ancestor. And here in Australia, how things work in regards to native title is that you identify your apical ancestors, your first contact ancestors to an area, And if you can prove your bloodline to them, then that is essentially how you register for native title over your traditional homelands. So my father's grandmother was our apical ancestor. And on the other side, it's the same great-grandmother through my father's grandfather on my Wailwan line. So people tend to think that colonization happened a long time ago, but really we're only talking in my family three generations. At the time in those camps and from history is that, yeah, speaking languages, undertaking traditional dances, keeping our song lives alive, weaving, making and all of those things were not necessarily encouraged. So it was generally a survival era where people would work and try and survive in those camps. Whereas today, one generation later, there's been great movement around social justice here in this country. I'm the first generation in my family to be able to finish year 12. My father, at the time, men were generally made to leave school at around the age 14 and women were encouraged to leave at 16 because they were seen as that's essentially, you know, women domestic servitude and men working the land. Whereas I was able to go to year 12 and then on to university and undertake degrees in a number of fields. And as we know, knowledge is power. And so that essentially gives us across a generation a lot more self-determination and control over our own lives, socioeconomically speaking.
The policies that led to the Stolen Generations effectively ended in 1967 when Aboriginal people were finally given some important rights as citizens of Australia, at least legislatively. But child removal did not stop cold in its tracks. It continued, by some accounts, into the 1970s, and even then was effectively replaced by similar policies under the guise of different rationales.
Today, here in Australia, Aboriginal children are removed at the same rates or higher rates than what they were during what's known as the Stolen Generations. And this is why I talk about colonization hasn't ended, it's transformed. So when people talk about colonization as an event that happened in the past, or they try to talk about post-colonization, it's very easy academically with evidence to support that colonization hasn't actually ended in this country. So for example, the Stolen Generation policies might say that children of a certain mixed race can be taken from their families and placed in institutions or in homes. But today, that's just turned into what's known as the Department of Community Services here in Australia, and they continue to remove Aboriginal children from their families for reasons unlike what they might remove non-Indigenous children. So I just think it's dangerous if you're removing any children under a concept that can't be clearly defined.
So what did happen in 1967? And how else did things change for Aboriginal people after that?
In 1967, the Australian government ran a referendum to ask the Australian public if Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples had a right to vote in the country. Now, I'm not a politically minded person, so to speak, but if I was to look at that from my cultural and historical point of view, if you don't have the right to vote in your own country, you're not necessarily classified as an equal citizen. So 1967 referendum was about the right to vote. But when you speak to activists and Aboriginal people that were living at the time, we celebrate this now that Aboriginal people, yes, did get the referendum at 97% or something, but it came along with a whole lot of other issues around native title, land rights, how people are to identify. Before 1967, we were a large group of people who all had a common cause and where they start to place ways in which you need to identify yourself or ways in which they can control things more. It can actually be a way to divide people. We're already a small population and so we have power in numbers. As soon as you start to make any divisions in that process, then it becomes harder for us to achieve real social justice or land rights in this country.
Tim Selwyn points to some of the dark indicators that there is certainly much more work to be done on behalf of Aboriginal people to overcome the disastrous effects of colonization and its policies.
We have the highest levels of incarcerations. We have the highest levels of domestic violence. We have the highest level of drug and alcohol abuse per capita. For 3% of the population, we sit way, way too high. All this is in relationship to being conquered and dispossessed and removed. That's what happens to those people.
So, of course, colonization has been horribly detrimental to the ability of Aboriginal people to practice their cultures and languages. And even in the alarmingly recent past, policies that, it is argued, amount to genocide have made it essentially illegal for them to even exist outside of Western societal constructs. But as our guests have pointed out, resistance has also always been a part of the story. Today, that resistance continues in all kinds of forms, from pressing for further recognition of rights to educating people on the true history of Australia and its original inhabitants. Our guests and others are working to not only revitalize their culture and reintroduce it to people who have generationally lost their connection to it, but also to correct the record where lies persist and invite people to interact with the culture when and where appropriate. And an important piece of these efforts to revitalize, educate, and advocate is that they are being led by Aboriginal people themselves. Rob Hyatt again.
I would actually say that not just the Aboriginal community, but our broader communities, there is a real desire to want to learn and want to understand our history, our past, because I really do believe that we need to be able to tell the story of our past. We're having this process now in this country around truth-telling, that people understand the truth of our past and the Aboriginal experience. And from that perspective, then how do we move forward with the knowledge that unfortunately some of that history still does impact today? Some of the social disadvantage that we see, some of the trauma that we see is a result of that past. Can we learn it? Can we move forward? The government in some areas are working with Aboriginal communities and Aboriginal organisations. We see the growth of Aboriginal-controlled organisations right across our state in particular and other parts of the country as well. I would still say, though, unfortunately, the reality is that the lived experience for many Aboriginal people still is one of disadvantage, is one of still not truly having voice. We are pushing that, obviously, heading towards having a voice to Parliament, which is really important for Aboriginal people. They're still not quite there. The desire is great. And we run, for example, through the Koori Heritage Trust, cultural competency workshops, where we engage with corporate, government, small organisations around cultural awareness and learning how to engage with Aboriginal people, how to engage with product or employment opportunities or business opportunities, whatever it might be. And I still think people sit back and think, oh, that's an Aboriginal thing. We'll wait to see what they say and then we'll go with it. I actually think it would be much better if people went out and learnt, because eventually if it's something you need to vote on, then you need to learn about it. Then once you learn about it, you can make an informed choice, hopefully that supports Aboriginal people. And so a lot of great things are happening. We just still have a long way to go. I think we're doing over 300-odd workshops a year, just my small team, let alone all the amazing Aboriginal people out there doing very similar work. We are still doing so much education. It just shows how far we still have to go.
One institution that offers education on these issues is the Australian Museum, where, again, our guest Laura McBride is director of their First Nations programs.
So the Australian Museum is turning 200 in 2027, so in 4 years. The Australian Museum is old in the sense of being an Australian institution. There's not really much that's much older than this museum. The Australian Museum immediately started collecting from our people before it was even a physical institution. So anthropologists or scientists would collect from Aboriginal people, and essentially most of the early collections were sent back overseas. So a lot of our really important collections, particularly from Sydney and New South Wales, sit in overseas museums. So it'll be fantastic once we have more Aboriginal academics and more people working in museums and galleries for us to be able to go over and find our cultural objects in those countries and see what we can do about bringing that stuff home. We have an Aboriginal collection here at the Australian Museum, which is around 17,000 objects. South Australian Museum has the largest collection currently. But the collection itself from which we teach everything is a very colonial collection, in that when Westerners came here, essentially Aboriginal people were classified as native savages or hunter-gatherers. So, for example, our New South Wales Aboriginal collection is primarily made up of men's weaponry. That's because that is what they collect, because people collect towards their theories. So people often think that museums are places of truth, but museums have never really been neutral. And so that's a role that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples play in this museum. We've recently developed our own First Nations division so that we can be self-determining across collections, repatriation of ancestral remains and secret sacred objects, but also to ensure that when we build our exhibitions, programs or education materials, all of them are neutral materials. So they are historically factual, but we are interpreting Aboriginal people histories and cultures with Aboriginal people.
We also asked Rob Hyatt to further describe the work done at the Koori Heritage Trust, where he is the Manager of Education and Visitor Experience.
The Koori Heritage Trust was established in 1985. Back in 1985, it was essentially an Aboriginal display of artefacts and artworks, but we had some amazing people and an amazing elder, Uncle Jim, that established this section within the museum, the Koori Heritage Trust. At that point in time, within a museum, the Aboriginal culture was basically behind glass. And the story of that culture was really from an old Eurocentric anthropological point of view. And so we wanted to give voice to those artefacts and those objects. With that, we started to tell the stories that it was a living culture, that these artefacts had a presence of the culture and the artwork at the time, but they actually are still telling us a story today. And then we started to see more additions to the collections and the artworks from a contemporary sense of what our artists are doing today. And so in our collections, which only trained curators can go through and touch and move around, we have around 65,000 items. It's the largest collection of Aboriginal artefacts and artworks in southern Australia. A lot of it is obviously preserved in special conditions, but we have a lot of it also on display within our collections, and it is a little bit of a museum experience from that perspective, but at the same time, we have our experienced officers on hand to always engage with visitors to let them know this is what you're looking at, this is what it is. We will actually purchase new works each year from Aboriginal Victorian artists that go into our collections. So it's not preserving just the culture of the past, but making sure we continue to preserve that living culture of the present as well.
As Rob points out, the culture of Aboriginal peoples is alive. Despite how many millennia it stretches back in time, whether 60 or 120, it still exists today. And it is ultimately a living history that should not be thought of as existing solely in the past. Which brings us to an important question from Laura McBride.
People need to start to think about why are Indigenous cultures in natural history museums? Essentially, they're an extension of the animal collections. That's what natural history museums collect. They collect natural history. So they focus on geology, paleontology, history in a natural sense, as well as, of course, the natural sciences, of which Aboriginal and Pacifica peoples in this region were classified. In America, that's why Native American cultures would be within natural history museums and not just plain history museums themselves. Scientists just didn't collect our cultural objects. They did collect our bodies for scientific study. We weren't here at the Australian Museum active collector of ancestral remains, although we did collect them and we ended up with quite a few through donations. Those museums that do collect ancestors, people's human remains, hair, nail samples often have much larger collections than us. Over time, we have amassed hundreds of Aboriginal and Pacific ancestors, and here at the Australian Museum, we've been repatriating them to their homelands for the last 35 years. Repatriation of ancestral remains and secret sacred objects is a very complex process, but today it's completely community-led. So we will identify to communities that we hold ancestors from their region, and then we will help the communities negotiate how they might like to return those ancestors. There's always difficulty in where do we rebury people that won't be developed, where is culturally appropriate to do so? Can we get communities working together enough to be able to undertake such a significant return? Because this is a legacy of colonization, but so is the fact that we're not able to all negotiate and be able to have our own lands where we can return people. So Aboriginal people do own a lot of land in Australia, but it's certain groups of Aboriginal people, primarily in the Northern Territory, Western Australia and South Australia. Here in New South Wales, we are achieving land rights and native title, but we have nowhere near the amount of land that others might have to be able to return our ancestors. It's a priority of mine, the repatriation of ancestral remains. As I said before, my great-grandmother was my first contact ancestor. So there are people in our collections who were collected at that time. They are not human remains from a long, long time ago. These are people's relatives, and we care for them as such. And we treat them with great respect and try and get them home, reburied on their countries, along the lines of exactly what that community might like from us.
And again, much of what we've described in this episode is also relevant to the Torres Strait Islander peoples, though their history is their own, and we encourage you to learn about it. But of course, it's not only Aboriginal people of the past who deserve respect. We asked Tim Selwyn how visitors can responsibly take part in tours and experiences he and his company provide related to Aboriginal culture today.
You will never, ever know what it's like to walk on somebody's country unless you take your shoes off and physically walk on that country. It's just a little note to remember when you travel and when you talk to people. Here's the thing. The whole surface of a mother is special and sacred. She has more sacred places that are more personal to people, but the protocol is the important part. How to come in, how to be welcomed, how to conduct yourself. Bloodline custodians here just remind people that the plants and the animals are their ancestors, and they like you to walk with good intention. But most importantly, they want you to look after each other, give each other a cuddle, and make sure you support each other when you walk through their country. I would just recommend to people that they come in slowly, walk with good intention, and don't be in a hurry. Give yourself plenty of time to connect. We call it land. Give yourself time to land. There's many people like me. There's lots of tourism out there. There's lots of educators out there. Just trust your instinct. Trust your gut on when you plug into, and if something doesn't feel right, if something sends you a little bit of a red flag, well, maybe it's not for you just yet. You got to understand that when you do something a lot, you get really, really good at it. And Aboriginal people have been in this continent for 100,000 years. We got it right. I'm arrogantly going to say today, we got that right. And also remember, it's consequences for actions. You're never alone when you walk through the bush. You have ancestors watching you, looking after you. Mother Earth will give us everything we need to sustain life. We just need to listen. We need to slow down, stop, get out of our heads. Refer to that computer if you like, that brain. You can pop back up there from time to time. But trust your instinct. Take your time.
Thank you to our guest, Laura McBride. The Australian Museum is located in Sydney and can be found online at australian.museum. Thanks also to Rob Hyatt. The Koori Heritage Trust is located in Melbourne and can be found online at kooriheritagetrust.com.au. And lastly, thank you to Tim Selwyn. Giri Gira is based out of the Central Coast region of New South Wales and can be found online at girigira.com.au. Be sure to follow Lost Cultures Living Legacies on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And we'd love your feedback. If you could, please rate this podcast and leave us a review. We'd really appreciate it. You can also find us online at travelandleisure.com/lostcultures. In our next episode, we'll explore the Pict culture of Scotland, so make sure to come back for that. Until then, enjoy your travels. Lost Cultures, Living Legacies is a production of Travel and Leisure and Dot Dash Meredith. I'm your host, Alicia Prakash. Lottie Lemarie is our executive producer. Jeremiah McVeigh is our writer and co-producer. Dominique Arciero is our audio engineer and editor. Stacey Leska is our researcher. Kyle Avalone is our fact checker. This episode was reviewed by Brian Ahern, a panelist on Dot Dash Meredith's Anti-Bias Review Board, as well as Mackenzie Price, Director of Anti-Bias Initiatives. Jennifer Del Sol is Director for Audio Growth Strategy and Operations at Dot Dash Meredith. Nina Ruggiero is Digital Editorial Director for Travel and Leisure. Maya Catrew-Levine is Senior Editor at Travel and Leisure.